Welcome to The Critique. Today we are reviewing a white paper titled The Violence Viability Architecture, which integrates ecological foundations, governance systems, and cultural narratives into a systems framework for evaluating civilizational stability. Let's get right into the feedback. To briefly calibrate our approach today, the intellectual rigor of this material is truly impressive, specifically the seamless synthesis of Johan Galtung's Violence Triangle and John McMurtry's Life Value Ontoaxiology.
I completely agree. The conceptual models presented here, like the viability phase diagram, are exceptionally strong. Because the theoretical foundation is so remarkably solid, our critique today is going to bypass the foundational theories and focus entirely on high-level application and structural flow to maximize the paper's impact on its target audience of policymakers and scholars.
Exactly. So, moving right into our first area of focus, the material makes a strong case for life ground governance by highlighting generalized theoretical scenarios like how a drought might reduce agricultural productivity or how economic inequality causes stress.
Grounding the theoretical architecture in specific historical case studies would significantly enhance its utility for your target audience of policymakers.
Let's unpack that, because as I understand it from the notes, the framework is beautifully constructed, but the examples used to illustrate it remain at a, well, a very high altitude.
Right, yeah.
We see frequent mentions that ancient irrigation-based civilizations collapsed, or that investments in renewable energy help support the life ground.
Which is McMurtry's term for the fundamental ecological and social requirements for human survival.
Exactly. Just so everyone is on the same page.
And that altitude you mentioned, that is exactly where the paper stumbles a bit right now. It relies almost entirely on generalized, abstract examples to illustrate its points. While these broad hypotheticals certainly explain the concepts in a theoretical sense, the target audience of policymakers requires something much more tangible.
Because they're dealing with reality, not theory.
Precisely. Policymakers operate in a world of messy, conflicting data. They need to see exactly how this complex, multi-layered framework maps onto documented, real-world events to fully trust its diagnostic power. Without that anchor to reality, the framework remains a philosophical exercise rather than a functional tool.
I can see what you're getting at there. If I am a policy analyst reading this, I am asking myself, you know, how does this help me interpret the crisis on my desk right now?
Right.
If the text only gives me hypothetical droughts or abstract economic inequality, the cognitive burden is entirely on me to figure out if the violence viability architecture actually works in practice. So what is the actionable move here to fix that?
I'd strongly suggest integrating one or two detailed historical or contemporary case studies that trace the complete systemic pathway from life ground degradation to cultural violence and ultimately to collapse or transformation.
Instead of just sprinkling abstract hypotheticals randomly throughout the chapters.
Exactly. Anchor the entire theoretical progression around a narrative case study that the reader can follow from the base of the life ground all the way up to direct violence.
Let's actually test this on air to see how it might look. The paper talks about Galtung's violence triangle: structural, cultural, and direct violence. If we take a modern crisis, like, say, the Syrian civil war, how does this framework map onto those events?
Oh, that is a perfect example to use. Let's map it. We start at the base, the life ground. Between 2006 and 2010, Syria experienced a catastrophic drought. Agricultural productivity collapsed, and hundreds of thousands of farmers migrated to urban centers.
Which is a clear, undeniable life ground failure. The ecological foundation cracked.
It absolutely did. And that leads directly into institutional mismanagement, or what Galtung would call structural violence. The Assad regime cut agricultural subsidies right when the farmers needed them most, exacerbating the inequality and poverty.
So the system was failing to regulate the stress at that level.
Precisely. Then we move up to the cultural layer. The framework discusses concepts like repression projection narratives, where a society represses its internal failures and projects the blame onto an outgroup, or the concept of chosenness, myth, trauma. This idea that a group believes it is divinely special but historically victimized.
Right.
In Syria, you saw these exact cultural narratives activate along sectarian lines to justify the escalating tensions.
And finally, that boils over into direct physical violence, the eruption of the Civil War itself. Wow, seeing it mapped out like that instantly proves the utility of the diagnostic tools.
Doesn't it?
It bridges the gap between the ontology of the life ground and the messy reality of geopolitics.
Walking the reader through those specific historical steps proves the model actually works. You could do the exact same thing with the collapse of the Maya civilization. Dedicate a few paragraphs specifically detailing their ecological degradation, perhaps the deforestation and water scarcity, mapping that to their institutional failure, and then showing the resulting structural violence that ultimately led to systemic collapse.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second, though. I see your point about adding the Maya case study, but does that risk pulling the reader too far into the past? If the goal is modern policymaking, shouldn't the author strictly stick to contemporary examples like Syria?
It's a valid concern, but I think there's immense value in showing both. The Maya example provides a complete, closed-loop look at total civilizational collapse, which is the ultimate warning the framework provides. The Syrian example shows the framework functioning in real time in a modern, complex geopolitical landscape.
Ah, I see.
Using both proves that the violence viability architecture is universally applicable across different eras and scales. But keep in mind, these are just a few out of all possible ways to show the framework functioning in action. The author could just as easily use the 2008 financial crisis or the current climate migration in the Sahel. The specific event matters less than the act of mapping the theory to reality.
That makes total sense. Giving the reader a specific narrative makes the dense systems thinking much easier to digest, because human psychology is inherently wired for narrative.
Absolutely.
Let's look closely at the section discussing reflexive governance and the four regulatory layers of civilizational viability. This brings us to our second lens, which is completeness and focus.
Addressing the practical limitations and potential trade-offs of the proposed governance model would make the central argument much more robust.
A key theme running through this material seems to be the necessity of moving toward a viability-oriented civilization. The text outlines a regulatory stack: homeostasis, allostasis, adaptation, and reflexivity, just so we don't leave anyone behind. Homeostasis is maintaining a stable baseline. Allostasis is a rapid, temporary response to a stressor. Adaptation is a long-term structural change.
And reflexivity is the highest level, right? A society's ability to critically reevaluate its own core values and purpose.
Exactly. That is beautifully laid out in the paper.
It is. I wonder, though, if the author has fully considered the temporal friction between these layers. Right now, the paper presents reflexive regulation and life ground governance as the ultimate solutions to systemic stress, but it doesn't adequately consider the structural limitations or counterarguments to this approach.
You're talking about the time it takes to actually execute these things.
Exactly. Reflexive governance requires deep critical inquiry, societal redesign, and massive long-term planning. Inherently, that takes a massive amount of time. This can fundamentally clash with the need for rapid, immediate allostatic responses during an acute, fast-moving crisis.
So when a civilization is hit by a sudden shock, like a global pandemic, a massive earthquake, or a rapid financial collapse, the luxury of reflexive, long-term deliberation simply might not exist.
That is the crux of the issue. When the house is currently on fire, you cannot form a committee to discuss the architectural philosophy of the neighborhood. You need an allostatic response. You need water on the flames immediately.
I love the theoretical ambition of the paper, but you are right to point that out.
And if we push that even further into the realm of modern democratic structures, we hit another massive friction point. Modern political terms are typically 2 to 4 years long. Politicians are incentivized to provide immediate, visible solutions to get reelected. The life ground, however, operates on ecological timescales, decades, centuries, millennia.
Right.
How does the text reconcile the friction between the time it takes to build political consensus and the time required to maintain ecological stability? Right now, it largely ignores it.
I hear that, but I have to push back again. If we demand the author add all these temporal disclaimers and dive into the cynicism of 4-year election cycles, do we risk diluting their visionary premise? This is supposed to be a paradigm-shifting framework. If we bog it down with the gridlock of contemporary politics, does it lose its aspirational power?
I don't view it as diluting the vision at all. I view it as bulletproofing the argument. A visionary framework that ignores reality will be dismissed as utopian by the very people it's trying to reach. By addressing the trade-offs head-on, the author inoculates the white paper against the most obvious criticisms a pragmatic policymaker might have.
That's a very fair point.
Friction between long-term viability planning and short-term crisis management. You have to explicitly discuss how the framework accounts for these temporal or democratic constraints.
So how do they actually do that? What does that look like on the page?
There are a few ways to approach it. You could include a brief discussion on how a society can maintain swift allostatic crisis responses while simultaneously engaging in reflexive deliberation. For instance, you might propose a constitutional separation of emergency infrastructure powers from long-term cultural narrative building. Basically, creating a bifurcated system where emergency responders aren't held up by philosophical debates.
That's a fascinating concept. You have the fire department operating on allostasis, while a separate civic body works on the reflexivity of urban planning.
Exactly. Another option is to openly address the counterargument regarding modern political terms. You could offer a specific institutional mechanism to bridge that gap, such as proposing independent life ground stewardship councils that operate outside the standard election cycle.
Similar to how a Supreme Court or certain central banks operate, but focused on ecological and social viability.
Spot on. These additions show policymakers that the author profoundly understands the structural constraints they work within. But as always, keep in mind these are just a few illustrative ways you might address this limitation. The author might have an entirely different institutional mechanism in mind to explore this tension, so long as the friction itself is openly acknowledged.
That makes a ton of sense. Acknowledging the counterarguments always strengthens the primary argument. It shows the author has surveyed the entire landscape, not just the paths that conveniently support their conclusion. It creates a vivid challenge for the reader to ponder, which elevates the entire reading experience.
It really does. And speaking of the reading experience, that brings us perfectly to our third and final lens for this critique, which is structure and flow.
Yes. As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is that the paper moves from a deep theoretical understanding of violence and viability directly into a highly practical diagnostic tool in Chapter 9, and that jump feels a bit rough.
Weaving elements of the diagnostic worksheets earlier into the text would create a more seamless bridge between your abstract theory and its practical application.
Let's look closely at how the document unfolds. We spend the first 8 chapters immersed in an incredibly rich, multi-layered philosophical and sociological architecture. We are exploring the ontology of value, the civilizational stability landscape, and the deep cultural attractors of conflict. It's heavy, cerebral work.
It is a fascinating journey, but it requires a very specific type of cognitive engagement. The structural issue here is that after building this incredibly dense theoretical model for 8 chapters, the paper suddenly introduces a highly practical diagnostic worksheet for policy analysis in Chapter 9.
Right.
This abrupt shift from high-level philosophy to a functional bulleted checklist can be quite jarring. Because the worksheet appears all at once at the very end of the theoretical journey, it feels somewhat detached from the preceding chapters. It almost feels as though two different documents, a philosophical treatise and a policy manual, have been stitched together at the last moment.
Let's talk about the cognitive whiplash there. Reading about dualism, Manichaeism, Armageddon, which, for our listeners, is essentially the cultural narrative that splits the world into absolute good versus absolute evil to justify extreme measures, uses a totally different part of the brain than scoring a policy on a scale of strengthens, neutral, or weakens.
Exactly.
You are asking a policymaker to switch from abstract contemplation to administrative execution with zero warning. I can easily see a reader abandoning the document right at the finish line because the tone shift is just so dramatic.
That is exactly the risk. The reader hasn't been primed to interact with the text in a diagnostic way until Chapter 9. They've been conditioned to be passive absorbers of theory, not active evaluators of policy.
So how can we smooth out this structural transition? How do we make the worksheet feel like the natural, inevitable culmination of the text rather than a surprise appendix?
The best approach here is to preview the diagnostic questions throughout the earlier chapters, so the reader is organically trained to think in terms of policy evaluation long before they reach the final worksheet. By embedding the language and the specific questions of the diagnostic tool directly into the theoretical chapters, you condition the reader's mind.
So they are practicing as they read?
Yes. When they finally reach chapter 9, the worksheet won't feel like a sudden shift. It will feel like the grand synthesis of everything they have been quietly practicing for the last 80 pages.
There is a beautiful symmetry to that approach. You are essentially teaching the reader how to use the tool piece by piece while they are learning the theory. Can you walk me through exactly where and how they should sprinkle these questions in?
Absolutely. Let's look at chapter 2, where the author discusses structural violence, the ways in which institutions and systems inherently disadvantage certain groups. Instead of just ending that theoretical discussion, you conclude the section by introducing a relevant worksheet question right there in the main text.
What would that look like?
You could write, "Therefore, when evaluating any new initiative, the critical diagnostic question becomes, does this policy reduce systemic inequalities in health and education, or does it calcify them?"
Ah, so you are giving them the theory and then immediately handing them the specific tool to measure it.
Exactly. You could do the same thing in Chapter 3 when explaining that dualism, Manichaeanism, Armageddon concept we just talked about. You could feature a visual call-out box or a shaded margin note containing the relevant cultural attractor indicator question from the final appendix. Something like, "Diagnostic check. Does this political rhetoric rely on framing an outgroup as an existential threat?"
That's brilliant.
Doing this prepares the reader at every single step. The transition goes from jarring to perfectly seamless. Of course, once again, these are just a few illustrative ways to smooth out the structural transition. The author might prefer to use end-of-chapter summaries, reflective prompts, or bolded key takeaways to achieve the exact same effect. The method matters less than the act of foreshadowing the final tool.
I really appreciate how that advice honors the author's intent. The goal is clearly to provide a functional tool for policy analysis. By scattering the seeds of that tool throughout the early chapters, the final harvest in Chapter 9 becomes incredibly satisfying for the reader. Is the connection between the high-level theory and the practical application fully established in the material right now? Yes, intellectually it is. But structurally, it asks the reader to make a massive leap over a canyon.
A leap they might not be willing to make.
Exactly. By sprinkling the practical diagnostic questions into the theoretical text, we build a sturdy, gradual bridge over that gap. It respects the reader's cognitive load and maximizes the overall impact of the piece.
I think that is the perfect way to frame it. The intellectual foundation of the violence viability architecture is already rock solid. These structural adjustments will simply ensure that it lands with the exact impact the target audience needs.
This has been a deeply insightful look into a truly remarkable piece of work. To quickly recap the core feedback we've discussed today, the source material is theoretically brilliant, but it can be elevated to its maximum potential by implementing three high-level changes. First, anchor the abstract theory by integrating specific historical or modern case studies, like mapping out the Syrian Civil War to vividly prove the framework's diagnostic power.
Second, explicitly address the practical limitations and temporal frictions of reflexive governance, such as the clash between ecological timelines and short-term election cycles, to make the central argument more robust against pragmatic counterarguments.
And finally, integrate elements of the diagnostic worksheet earlier in the text to organically train the reader, easing their cognitive load and improving the structural flow from theory to practice. We want to sincerely thank the listener for submitting such a rigorous, thought-provoking, and deeply necessary white paper. We warmly invite you to implement these actionable suggestions and to submit your revised work back in again for more feedback. Keep challenging yourself to refine your ideas, and we look forward to seeing the next iteration.